Attention, attention. This is History Lost in Time.
And welcome to episode 49 of the History Lost in Time podcast. This podcast is available in German and English on YouTube, Spotify, and Podcast.de, with social media presences on Blue Sky and Instagram.
The topic of this episode.
Only our sense of duty to the people and the fatherland has brought us to this position. If somewhere the important man of recognized name and reputation from a proven past is found, believe me, there will be no happier hour for me than the one when I can place the office entrusted to me into his hands. This quote from page 14 of Bernd Braun's book about the chancellors, which I'll mention shortly, comes from Chancellor Konstantin Fehrenbach and is from his first statement as chancellor before the Reichstag. What must be going through a person's mind when they comment on the office of head of government with such words, when they say right away upon taking office that they are already looking forward to being able to hand over this burden? As the episodes about his predecessors make clear, episodes 45, 41 and 37, the office of Reich Chancellor in Weimar was always a difficult and unpopular one. Those in office almost always inherited terrible things from their predecessors and had little room to maneuver, and they rarely remained in the hot seat of head of government for long. Konstantin Fehrenbach was the first bourgeois head of government of the Weimar Republic, and this episode is about him. His reign encompassed the aftermath of the Kapputsch, the aftermath of the 1920 Reichstag elections, the referendums in the East, the partial occupation of the Ruhr in 1921, and two reparations conferences. Quite a lot for less than a year in office.
Political agenda and background.
Konstantin Fehrenbach is definitely one of the forgotten German heads of government. I'd bet that if I asked 100 randomly selected Germans about him, at best only a handful would know who he is. I admit that his name always escapes me when I list the German heads of government in my head. But why has he been more or less forgotten?
The sources that were used.
Two books are my main sources for Fehrenbach. Hans Mommsen, Aufstieg und Untergang der Republik von Weimar, 1918-33. Translation, Rise and Fall of the Republic of Weimar, 1918-33, published by Ullstein Propyläen, Berlin, 1998. And Bernd Braun, Die Reichskanzler der Weimarer Republik, Translation, The Reichschancellors of the Weimar Republic, published by Verlag Kohlhammer, Stuttgart, 2013. Let's start at the beginning. Konstantin Fehrenbach was born on January 11, 1852, in Wellendingen in the Black Forest. Today it's part of Bonndorf and is located about 40 kilometers southeast of Freiburg. At that time it was a small village with a few hundred inhabitants. Konstantin was one of seven children of the village school teacher Johann Fehrenbach. Initially, he was taught by his father at the village school. His parents insisted that he become a priest. So in 1865, at the age of 13, he was sent to the Archbishop's Boys' Boarding School in Freiburg. Freiburg subsequently became Fehrenbach's permanent home, where he and his family always remained deeply rooted. At the ages of 18 and 19, he witnessed the founding of the German Empire during the Franco-Prussian War of 1870-71. He is the only Weimar Chancellor to have consciously experienced this. In 1871-72, he began studying theology in Freiburg but dropped out. While on a cab ride to a seminary, horse-drawn cab, that is, he turned back, then abandoned his theology studies and switched to law. Whether this was related to the so-called Kulturkampf, translation the cultural struggle, or to meeting his future wife is unknown. In any case, he completed his law studies in 1879 and 81, passing both state examinations. In 1882, he opened a law firm in Freiburg, which he ran until 1921.
In that respect, he was quite modern. After all, many politicians today are either lawyers or civil servants. Fehrenbach's parents were apolitical but very Catholic, which led to a natural affinity with the Center Party and monarchism. As a teenager and young adult, Fehrenbach experienced the Kulturkampf. This was a political conflict between Chancellor Bismarck and the Catholic Church. Bismarck, who himself came from Protestant Prussia, viewed the Catholic Church and the Center Party as an extension of the Pope in Rome and thus as a foreign actor within the German Empire. He wanted to force German Catholics and the German Catholic Church to be loyal to the German Empire and to push back papal influence. The Kulturkampf ended in 1878 and was diplomatically resolved during the 1880s. This is, of course, a very simplified description of this conflict, but it should suffice for this purpose. Local repercussions of the Kulturkampf included, for example, the position of Archbishop of Freiburg remaining vacant from 1868 to 82, and the imprisonment of all but three escaped candidates for the priesthood in 1875 for refusing to take a cultural examination. The Kulturkampf and its repercussions may therefore have prompted Fehrenbach to become politically active within the Center Party. In 1879, Fehrenbach married Maria Hosner, the daughter of a lawyer who was 3 years his junior. Their daughter Elisabeth was born in 1880. She married in 1905 and had 7 children. Fehrenbach completely embraced the role of father and later grandfather. Unfortunately, the marriage was not without tension and became increasingly distant. Fehrenbach began his political career at the local level and became active in Freiburg's city council in 1884. He served as a city councillor from 1895 to 1920. He also became so active in local clubs, for example as chairman of the men's choir, that he was considered the most popular Freiburger and was made an honorary citizen during his lifetime in 1920. From 1885 to 87, he was member of the Baden State Parliament. The Kulturkampf was still fresh in the collective memory of the Center Party, which is why the party pursued a confrontational course against the Baden government. Fehrenbach, in contrast, attempted a compromise course that was unpopular within his own party. As a result, he lost his state parliament seat. He did not return to the state parliament until 1901, and his cooperative approach was now well received. He became a leading center party politician in Baden and remained a member of the state parliament until 1913. In 1907, he was even elected president of the state parliament. From 1903 onward, he was also a member of the Reichstag, where he served until 1926. Fehrenbach was thus politically active at the local, state, and national levels. Until 1913, however, he remained rather reserved at the national level, concentrating more on Freiburg and Baden. Nevertheless, his party colleagues already called him Constantine the Great. In 1913, a Reichstag speech catapulted him to the front row of the Center Party at the national level. What had happened? I quote here from the Braun Book, page 60 following.
In the Alsatian town of Zabern, some Prussian officers stationed there had allowed themselves to be carried away by reckless attacks on the local population. The initially local conflict had escalated into a national constitutional crisis because the respective superior civil and military authorities, completely disregarding the patriotic feelings of the Alsatians, had trivialized this affair. Even the government representatives who had spoken in the debate before Fehrenbach again attempted to downplay the incidents. Konstantin Fehrenbach was the first representative to speak and criticized the government statement as a black day for the German Reich. If the military were allowed to operate outside the law, the German Reich would face destruction. Fehrenbach's rhetorically brilliant plea for a constitutional state and against the military as a state within a state earned him broad support from the Center Party, the Left Liberal Progress Party and the SPD, the political forces that would later establish the Weimar Republic.
Fehrenbach advocated for control of the military by parliament and government, while the military insisted on independence. In August 1917, Fehrenbach became chairman of the Reichstag's Budget Committee, considered the most important parliamentary committee. In June 1918, he was elected the last president of the Imperial Reichstag. The military defeat, the overthrow of the monarchies, and the revolution in November 1918 deeply shocked Fehrenbach. However, he quickly recovered and just a few weeks later was ready to work for the Center Party as a leading politician in the new republic. He ran as the leading candidate in the elections for the National Assembly in his home state of Baden. On February 14, 1919, he was elected president of the National Assembly with 98% of the vote. He enjoyed support from the far left to the far right. There's no better proof that he was viewed by all sides as a conciliatory and integrative figure. He was considered a gifted speaker, and his extensive experience at all political levels enabled him to engage in dialogue with anyone and reach compromises. As president of the parliament, he protested against the French annexation, or liberation, depending on the point of view, of Alsace-Lorraine by using his Baden origins, as can be seen in the Braun Book, page 26.
As president of the National Assembly, Konstantin Fehrenbach, in a debate about German territorial losses on July 9, 1919, made himself the spokesperson for Alsace-Lorraine, which had not been allowed to send representatives to Weimar. He protested sharply against the loss of the former Reich territory, calling it one of the greatest injustices in history. He explicitly cited his Baden origins. "I am the closest neighbor of Alsace-Lorraine. I know the country, the beautiful country, from countless journeys. In better times, I held assemblies in all the major squares in Alsace and Lorraine. I therefore believe I have the right to speak here on behalf of the German National Assembly for Alsace-Lorraine."
Fehrenbach's ability to compromise became crucial after the 1920 Reichstag election. In this election, the governing coalition of the SPD, the Center Party, and the DDP suffered a decisive defeat, although the Center Party had performed the best of the three, losing only 1.7 percentage points. The SPD lost 16 percentage points, the DDP more than 10. The winners of the election were the radical left-wing USPD, the right-wing conservative DNVP, and the right-liberal DVP. Also new to parliament was the communist KPD, albeit only in the form of a splinter group. Forming a government proved extremely difficult. A left-wing alliance of the SPD, USPD, and KPD lacked a majority and was also unrealistic due to the internal divisions among the three workers' parties. The Weimar coalition of the SPD, the Center Party, and the DDP no longer held a majority, and neither the SPD nor the DVP were willing to cooperate in a grand coalition. A right-wing alliance of the Center Party, the DNVP, the DVP, and the DDP was also impossible, as the DNVP completely rejected the Republic. The Mommsen book states on page 119,
"The Reichstag elections of June 6, 1920, after protracted coalition negotiations, led to the formation of the bourgeois minority cabinet under Konstantin Fehrenbach, whom the SPD assured of its tolerance until the Spar conference. The SPD withdrew from government responsibility. Already tired of coalitions as a result of the election results, the SPD refused to participate in a cabinet that included the German People's Party, DVP, whose ambivalent attitude toward the Republic had become apparent during the Kapp-Putsch and was, moreover, the main representative of the interests of the heavy industry. The loss of the majority for the Weimar coalition parties and the SPD's withdrawal from government responsibility indicated that one could hardly speak of an internal consolidation of the Republican parliamentary system. On the other hand, the German National People's Party, DNVP, and the Bavarian People's Party, BVP, were unwilling to assume parliamentary responsibility, which they associated with the burden of implementing the Treaty of Versailles. Consequently, a political limbo emerged in which the Centre Party and the DDP, with indirect support from the SPD, gained decisive influence over government affairs.
At this time, the reparations conference was taking place in Spa, in which the Germans were allowed to participate as negotiating partners for the first time. Therefore, a new government had to be formed. In other words, Fehrenbach allowed himself to be persuaded by President Ebert to take on this position because someone had to do it. As a widely respected politician, Fehrenbach seemed to be the best possible option. In this context, he then uttered the words I quoted at the beginning of the episode. It is noteworthy that his predecessor Gustav Bauer of the SPD had said almost the same thing about a year earlier, as can be seen from this quote from page 14 of the Braun Book.
"We are not in this position out of party interest, and even less, believe me, out of ambition. We are here out of a sense of duty, in the awareness that it is our damn duty to seek to save what can be saved."
Fehrenbach knew how difficult and thankless the office would be. Moreover, with the Center Party, the German Democratic Party DDP, and the German People's Party DVP, he had the support of just over a third of the parliament. At 68, Fehrenbach was by far the oldest Weimar Chancellor. Compared to post-war chancellors, however, his age puts him at a rather average level. Current Chancellor Friedrich Merz was already 69 when he took office, and the first Chancellor Konrad Adenauer was already 74. Fehrenbach was thus tasked with drafting the implementation of the Treaty of Versailles and the reparations terms with the Allies, a truly difficult political legacy to inherit. In the still highly hostile atmosphere, he threw his age and his own credibility into the fray. When Germany was quite aggressively urged by the Entente powers to disarm immediately, he said the following, quote from the Braun Book, page 85.
"I am an old man who will soon appear before the Supreme Judge. I therefore ask you to believe me when I say that I have a sincere desire to fulfill the treaty obligations I have assumed. However, nothing impossible should be demanded of us."
Fehrenbach achieved nothing at Spa. His request to allow the German Reich to maintain at least an army of 200,000 men was rejected. The Reichswehr was only allowed to have a strength of 100,000 men. Reparations in the form of money and coal were also demanded. Otherwise, the Allies threatened to occupy the Ruhr region. On July 26, 1920, Fehrenbach reported on the negotiations in the Reichstag with the following words, quote page 85.
"Anyone who may have entered the negotiations with a certain degree of optimism was quickly disabused of the fact that these were not negotiations between equals, but rather negotiations based largely on a dictate reinforced by an ultimatum."
Since the military situation hadn't changed, Germany had no choice but to accept that dictate. One small consolation during this period was Germany's success in the referendum in East and West Prussia in July 1920. The Treaty of Versailles awarded some territories in the east of the Reich to Poland. In other areas, the population was to decide for themselves through referendums. In the Allenstein region in southern East Prussia, almost 98% voted to remain part of Germany. In the West Prussian region of Marienwerder, the number was more than 92%. Therefore, only a few villages along the border were ceded to Poland. The vast majority of the territory remained part of the German Reich. Domestically, Fehrenbach had to address the Kapp-Putsch and its consequences, a difficult legacy of the SPD's time in power, and attempt to restore peace within the country. At least within the German People's Party, DVP, there was a gradual process of rethinking and the idea of working within the Republic rather than against it. The new Army Chief of Staff, von Seeckt, also attempted to keep the Reichswehr out of politics and pursue his goals within the Republic's framework rather than rebelling. While this wasn't exactly constructive in the interests of the Republic, it was at least better than open rebellion. However, the anti-Republican forces rallied around some leading figures of the Kapuche and within the extended circle of the German National People's Party, DNVP, and continued their fight illegally. In January 1921, at the Paris Reparations Conference, the total amount to be paid by Germany was set at 226 billion gold marks. France had originally demanded 269 billion. This sum corresponded to roughly 3 to 4 times the entire Reich budget and was therefore virtually impossible to manage, at best over an extremely long period of time. In addition, 12% of the value of German exports was to be paid to the Allies. The reparations were to be paid within 42 years. Furthermore, strict controls on German monetary and financial policy were planned, resulting in massive interventions in the country's sovereignty. The Fehrenbach government rejected these demands and instead proposed a sum of 50 billion gold marks. The Allies rejected this offer and in return occupied 3 bridgeheads on the eastern bank of the Rhine, the cities of Düsseldorf, Duisburg and Ruhrort. The government was helpless and could only stand by and watch the occupation. As a result, domestic political unrest arose in Germany. Among other things, there were communist uprisings in central Germany and Hamburg. The overall situation was complicated by the fact that another referendum took place on March 20, 1921, this time in Upper Silesia. This referendum had a less clear result than the 1920 referendum in East Prussia. 60% of the population in Upper Silesia voted for Germany, 40% for Poland. The pro-Polish provinces were mainly the industrial cities, while the pro-German provinces were mainly the agrarian rural districts. However, the ethnic groups were quite mixed, making it impossible to draw a simple dividing line between Germans and Poles. No matter where the border lay, there would be dissatisfied people and people on the wrong side of the border. The result was particularly close in the Strelitz region, for example, where 50.7% voted for Poland and 49.3% for Germany. What would a fair solution look like here? Naturally, Poles and Germans were equally dissatisfied and an uprising broke out in Silesia again, for the third time already. The German side again deployed Freikorps, since the regular Reichswehr was not allowed to be deployed in the plebiscite areas. On the Polish side, it was not the regular army that fought, but rather irregular local troops. French Entente troops stayed out of the fighting. There were no British troops. The Italians attempted to intervene in the fighting and suffered approximately 25 dead and 30 wounded. The fighting culminated around St. Annaberg Mountain, which was captured by German Freikorps fighters. A military stalemate ensued. The British commissioner suffered a nervous breakdown during the uprising and had to be replaced. After April 1921, the fighting subsided and ended with an armistice in July. A final settlement between Germany and Poland was not reached until 1922, but still no one was really happy. In April 1921, there was another round of reparations negotiations. At a conference in London, the Allies accommodated the Germans by reducing the total amount to 132 billion gold marks. While this was still significantly more than the Germans had proposed, it was at least only about half of the original French demand. However, this proposal also came with an ultimatum. Failure to accept it meant the occupation of the entire Ruhr region. The payment of 3 billion gold marks per year was demanded, and payments were to begin on August 31, 1921. The Fehrenbach cabinet should have shown strength and leadership on this issue. The foreign minister categorically rejected the demand, and Konstantin Fehrenbach declared his solidarity with him. The parties in the Reichstag now debated what to do, accept the offer and assume a virtually unaffordable burden, or reject the offer and accept the occupation of the Ruhr. Occupying the Rhineland, the bridgeheads, and the Ruhr area would have provided sufficient territory for a viable Rhine state as a buffer between Germany and France, and there were certainly efforts in France to secede such a state from the German Reich. An occupation could therefore have endangered Germany's integrity. Konstantin Fehrenbach, however, no longer played a role in this debate. On May 4, 1921, he resigned as chancellor. This process triggered a rethink for Gustav Stresemann of the German People's Party, DVP. He now wanted to accept reality and commit to fulfilling the Allied demands. However, the heavy industry lobby within the DVP prevailed with its negative stance, and so the DVP returned to opposition. A hastily assembled government was formed under Center Party politician Josef Wirth, who led an alliance of the Center Party, the German Democratic Party DDP, and the SPD. The USPD pledged support on foreign policy issues. Wirth's first task was to accept the London ultimatum. Thus, once again, a government faced a daunting task. Konstantin Fehrenbach was 69 years old when he resigned. After a brief 6-week respite, he was elected into the Center Party's parliamentary group leadership, thus remaining politically active. However, on August 16, 1921, he suffered a bitter personal loss when his wife died after a long illness. At the end of 1923, at the age of 72, Fehrenbach became parliamentary group leader when the previous holder of this position, Wilhelm Marx, became chancellor. Fehrenbach also supported the Center Party's shift to the right when, under Chancellor Luther, the party entered into a coalition with the right-wing conservative DNVP in 1925. The fact that this shift led to an alienation with more left-leaning Center Party politicians like Josef Wirth was deeply painful for Fehrenbach. After his time as chancellor, Fehrenbach became increasingly enthusiastic about protecting the Republic, even though he had initially been somewhat skeptical. This pro-Republican stance was later confirmed by the former chancellor's associates. In 1922, Fehrenbach became a parliamentary member of the State Court for the Protection of the Republic, which had been convened after the assassination of Foreign Minister Walter Rathenau by right-wing extremists. In 1924, Fehrenbach joined the Reichsbanner Schwarz-Rot-Gold, translation Reichsbanner Black-Red-Gold, which had been established to protect the Republic. From 1923 onward, he also served as deputy chairman of the Association for the Defense Against Anti-Semitism. His health collapsed quite suddenly in February 1926. After 6 weeks of illness, he died on March 26, 1926, presumably from the effects of a brain tumor. In obituaries, however, he was honored more as a person than as a chancellor. He was viewed as an interim chancellor. The liberal daily Vossische Zeitung wrote, see page 117, "In the global political atmosphere that still prevailed at that time, even a German statesman of greater stature would probably not have been able to reap any laurels. And today his party and his people mourn not a great statesman, but a warm-hearted and wise friend and leader, and a good German citizen."
A few finishing words.
The Brown Book states on page 140
how deeply rooted Konstantin Fehrenbach and his family were in Freiburg can also be seen in the fact that his grandson Clemens, who lived from 1911 to 2008, and his son Christoph Rosset, both lawyers, also resided or still reside in the house of their grandfather and great-grandfather,
at least at the time the book was written, in 2013. Fehrenbach was very successful as a politician in Freiburg and Baden. As a politician in the Reich, however, he was only successful as long as his ability to compromise and engage in dialogue was required. The roles of President of the Reichstag and Parliamentary Leader of the Center Party were therefore ideal for him. As Chancellor, however, other qualities were required. Here, Fehrenbach was only able to achieve limited success. In his favor, however, it must also be said that the circumstances were very difficult. The chancellors before and after him could only say yes and amen to the Allies' demands, and were helpless in the face of their military actions in the West. At least Fehrenbach managed to save the Republic from collapse after the Kapp Putsch and to bring further unrest, such as the Communist Party uprisings and the Third Silesian Uprising, under control in the medium run. His credit also includes the positive voting results in East Prussia and Upper Silesia in 1920 and 21. Overall, however, he was only an interim chancellor, the first chancellor with a minority cabinet, attempting to manage an impossible situation. His predecessors had had it no easier, and his successors would be no different. Fehrenbach's time as chancellor makes it clear that politics sometimes isn't about achieving brilliant victories, but rather about surviving the storm. That sometimes it's about daring to try to build bridges, especially when the divides are deep, and that stability must be fought for again and again. These insights are still very relevant today. On the other hand, Fehrenbach's time as chancellor also demonstrates how much the Treaty of Versailles strangled the governments of the Weimar Republic and poisoned the political climate. My personal conclusion from this era is that reparations money is cursed money that doesn't right injustices, but only creates new ones. I wonder whether Konstantin Fehrenbach would have agreed with me on this.
Thank you. This was History Lost in Time.